We'll make a start. Good evening, I'm Ray McCann, President of the Chartered Institute of Taxation. I'd like to welcome you to this and the latest CIOT IFS debate. This is the 12th debate we've had here. The aim of these debates is to promote understanding, discussion and debate, inevitably on tax and related matters. Each of the individuals on our panel, and I think I think this is going to be the best debate because this is the best panel we've ever had at any of these things. So each of these speakers, they bring separate and individual experiences. We've got economists, we've got academics, we've got tax people, and then we've got Gillian, who represents the Low Income Tax Reform Group, which we'll talk about. We've got a drinks reception afterwards. We'll finish pretty much on time, around about 8 o'clock. Each speaker will talk for 10 minutes or so. Tonight's event will be audio recorded, but it won't be visually recorded, so it's likely to appear on a blog put out by the CIRT. If anyone has got any issues with that, then if you let me know, then I'll try and see what arrangements will be made, but generally it's pretty routine for these kind of things. If I quickly introduce the speakers, we've got, I'll just take them in the order that they're in the book. We've got Stuart Adam from the IFS, who's a senior research economist. He was an author and editor of the Murley's Review of UK Taxation. Fran Bennett, who's a senior researcher and teaching fellow at Oxford University. Each of the speakers will say a little bit more about their own introduction, but there is a bio in the book that you've got. We've got Don Draper. Don't get excited. He's not an advertising executive. He was an Inland Revenue employee, as was I in the far distant past, and they then joined PricewaterhouseCoopers, as did I, so there's a good commonality there, Don. And then finally we've got Gillian, who I mentioned, who is part of our Low Income Tax Reform Group. Just before we get started, just another couple of minutes from me. I mean, I'm looking around the room and there are some people here who are of a vintage similar to mine, who will no doubt remember tax life before independent taxation came in. When I joined the Revenue in 1975, obviously I was a very young teenager, and I used to go to parties, and as always in Glasgow, the minute they heard you worked in the Inland Revenue, they didn't get angry, they asked you questions, and it was always, when should I get married? And I would usually sort of, you know, puffed up, yes, well, I can answer that question. Well, you should get married in April, and your girlfriend should get married in September. But don't we have to get married at the same time? Yes, 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 yes. But if your girlfriend gets married in September, because the tax system's bonkers, she'll get a tax refund because the tax system will treat her as having ceased all activities that she's ever undertaken, and she'll start again from scratch the following day. So it'll be fantastic. And what about me? Well, the longer you leave it, the less married man's allowance you'll get. So you'll not get as good a tax rebate. So I would get married in September, and then you can go on holiday with your then-wife's tax refund. Oh. What about kids? Best time to have children is on the 5th of April. Well, why is that? Because your child allowance doesn't get reduced at all. And I bet you in Scotland there were taxis driving to local maternity hospitals. You were like 10 minutes to go on the 5th. Hurry up, for God's sake, if it's born tomorrow, I'm going to be lost. So independent taxation was crazy. The other mad aspect about it, and of course when you're young, you just take these things because people train you and they tell you, these are the rules, you just follow the rules, is married women used to phone up and complain about their tax code or complain about this and be told that they had to get their husband's permission to talk to the Inland Revenue. Can you imagine the verbal abuse that used to come across the phone? You'd hold the phone out there sometimes. But the good news was any penalties that a married woman incurred was the husband's liability, so there was always an upside. Anyway, without further ado, the order that we're going to do this in, Stuart's going to start, Don will be next, Fran will follow Dawn, and then Gillian will no doubt bring up the rear in good fashion. So if I can ask Stuart to kick us off.
Thanks, Ray. I will be, I think, the only person speaking with slides, but it wouldn't be an IFS presentation without slides. It also wouldn't be an IFS presentation without facts and figures and evidence. And so I've got some of that at the end, but I suspect I've got more than 10 minutes of material, so I may end up skipping over some of that and can maybe bring it up in the discussion afterwards. But I think this is an area where actually, in some ways, the principles are more where the debate is at than the evidence. So for the benefit of those who don't have the same vintage as Ray, let me start with a bit of history. So we are holding this event today partly because it is 30 years this year since the legislation that introduced independent taxation. It's worth remembering just how far we've come, where we've come from. Before 1988, the legislation stated that a woman's income chargeable to tax shall be deemed to be her husband's income and not her income for income tax purposes, which, I mean, reads as a fairly shocking statement to today's eyes. I'm not sure anyone now would defend that appearing in legislation. And actually, it was fairly apparent even in the 70s and 80s that that was not really an acceptable way to run a tax system. And there was widespread agreement that something had to change. There was much less agreement on what it should change to, and there was a series of green papers and consultations and lots of ink spilt. Where we ended up in 1990 was a move from a largely joint system to a largely independent system. The old system was never fully joint taxation. There was always a wife's earned income allowance. There was also the option to elect to be taxed separately, although you would then lose the benefit of the additional married man's allowance, and so it was only worthwhile for high income two-earner couples to do that. And the new system wasn't a purely independent tax system either. There was a married couple's allowance reflecting the old married man's allowance. And it wasn't even quite gender neutral either, because at least initially, the married couple's allowance was by default paid to the husband. Over the course of the 1990s, first of all, the married couple's allowance moved away from being paid to the husband by default, and over time it was gradually phased out, except for couples where one was born before April 1935, who can still get it. The government spending about £200 million a year on that. And broadly speaking, in fact, the same year that the married couple's allowance was abolished completely for those born 1935 or afterwards, tax credits for children were introduced. And broadly speaking, the pattern that we've seen is away from the tax system supporting marriage towards the tax credit and benefit system supporting children. And that was roughly where we stood for a good decade or so. More recently, there have been a couple of changes bringing the family back into the income tax system through the high income child benefit charge and the marriage allowance, which I'll say more about in a minute. So before I talk about where we are now, so just some kind of principles. If you think of two extreme options as being purely individual and purely joint taxation of incomes, most countries, most of the time, are somewhere in between the two, as the UK always has been and is. But it's worth contrasting those two systems. In terms of choosing between them, they have various different properties. So in terms of family arrangements, only pure individual taxation, or for that matter, individual benefit assessment, will mean that whether or not you're married has no effect on the tax you pay or the benefits you're entitled to. Individual taxation, independent taxation, achieves neutrality in that respect. Anything else will create some sort of marriage penalty or marriage subsidy, depending on exactly how it's designed. And again, if it's based on cohabitation rather than marriage, there will be cohabiting couple penalties or couple subsidies. On the other hand, only purely joint assessment, will mean that how resources are distributed within a couple, so whether, for example, two of them have £20,000 each, or one has £40,000, the other one has nothing, that will only have zero effect on your tax and benefit position under a system of purely joint taxation. And it is impossible for a progressive tax and benefit system both to be neutral towards whether or not people are married and to be neutral towards the distribution of resources within a married couple. And so if you think that both of those are desirable principles, and not everyone would, then there is a tension between the two of them. There is a straightforward question of fairness in a distributional sense of how much is it fair that different types of people should pay, which I think in many ways boils down to the question of, do you think that someone's ability to pay depends on their spouse or partner's income or not? And again, there is a tension there between the desire to respect people's right to be treated as an independent individual, but also getting tax and benefit payments depending on the whole of an individual's circumstances, including the household that they live in. And that there are fundamental value judgments there, which is one reason I'm not really going to come off the fence tonight. There is also a matter of economic incentives that are created. So broadly speaking, individual assessment will tend to give weaker incentives for a family to have someone in work than joint taxation will. But independent taxation gives a stronger incentive to have for a second earner in work. Now, since second earners are generally much more responsive to financial incentives than the first earners in a household, that suggests that independent taxation is more efficient in terms of targeting incentives where they matter most. On the other hand, again, we may just make the judgment that we care more about ensuring that households have someone in work than we do about getting the second partner into work, or at least minimising the discouragement for a second partner to move into work. There has been some recent theory suggesting, for various complicated reasons, that actually something that resembles individual taxation for high earners and joint taxation for low earners might actually get you to a so-called optimal system. I should stress that, as ever, these models involve some fairly strong assumptions. So where does the UK fit into this? Well, the traditional way of describing the UK system is that we have independent taxation and joint benefits. But that's not quite right. It's partly not quite right because things I've already mentioned, marriage allowance, child benefit withdrawal, and the married couples allowance that still remains. But there's a second reason why it's not quite true. And I think in many ways it's fairer to say that we have individual taxation of labour income, earnings, and closer to optional joint taxation of capital. So for ordinary earnings from employment, income tax is largely individual, give or take things like the marriage allowance, national insurance contributions, even more so. But for capital income, independent taxation means that if couples are willing to pool resources, and again, they may not be, married couples can reduce their tax liabilities by simply transferring assets between them to the lower income spouse, and therefore have, if the lower income spouse is facing a lower marginal tax rate, they will pay less tax in total on their capital income. There's no income tax consequences of that transfer. Capital gains tax basically ignores it, so it's considered a no gain, no loss transfer. It's treated as if essentially the spouse was the one that had originally acquired the assets all along. There's no inheritance tax consequences of transferring assets to spouses. You can do that freely with no tax penalty. And of course, now your spouse can also inherit any unused inheritance tax nil rate band. So in effect, on death, for their capital, couples have what amounts to a double size joint allowance for what they can bequeath between them. And so in many ways, I think it's easier to think of what we have as being individual taxation for earnings, joint taxation optionally for capital if both members of the couple agree. Of course, that raises particularly interesting issues because it's not always easy to distinguish between labour income and capital income, and therefore, particularly in contexts like small companies, you get lots of cases of earnings being paid to a spouse, part of the company being part of some of the shares being in a spouse's name, regardless of how much work they are actually doing for it. And actually, I think this is an area where I think there is probably more economic theoretical analysis to be done, because while I think individual versus joint taxation has been fairly well explored, individual taxation of labour income and joint taxation of capital income, where there's some flexibility between them, I don't think is something that's really been studied very much. So what have we seen in the last few years? We've seen income tax start to depend on family circumstances again. So in January 2013, we had the high income child benefit charge withdrawing child benefit from families with a high income individual. In April 2015, we had the marriage allowance coming in, whereby 10% of your tax-free personal allowance for income tax, if you're not using it because you're a non-taxpayer, you're below the personal allowance, you can transfer that unused allowance to a basic rate tax-paying spouse or civil partner. I should say I'm using spouse as a shorthand for spouse or civil partner repeatedly in this, just for space reasons. Now, what can we say about those things? Again, there are some value judgments involved that I don't want to make. Both of them certainly complicate the system. Both of them are also withdrawn with income in particularly strange ways. So the married couple's allowance essentially is withdrawn at a cliff edge when the higher earner reaches the higher rate threshold. So it creates one of those situations where for a relatively small number of people, they can actually be worse off if their income rises than if it doesn't. And the high income child benefit charge is in some ways even more strange because it depends on the earnings of the higher earning member of the couple, sorry, the income of the higher income member of the couple is also withdrawn on income as income rises between £50,000 and £60,000 a year, which means how much you lose from earning an extra pound of income depends on nominal rates of child benefit. So first of all, we've got higher effective tax rates for families with more children. It also means that effective tax rates get higher over time just because child benefit rates increase with inflation, say, because the £50,000 and £60,000 thresholds don't increase with inflation. That's a pretty odd way to do things. But taken together, it's hard to see a clear principle for whether it's individual or joint taxation or something more specific that the government thinks ought to be determining your tax and benefit payments. So let me say a little bit more about on the complexity side. Let me throw some facts and figures at you before I stop. So the high income child benefit charge, when it was introduced, we estimated that just over 1 million families would be affected by this and they would lose an average of £1,300 each, therefore potentially saving the Exchequer £1.5 billion a year. Now, the latest figures I've seen suggest that only 840,000 families are actually losing from this. 550,000 have just opted out of receiving child benefit at all, and just under 300,000 are still receiving child benefit, but then paying some or all of it back through the tax charge in self-assessment income tax. Now, I've literally only just been looking at these statistics today, so it may be that I'm missing something, but as far as I can tell, that leaves about 300,000 high-income families unaccounted for, which may suggest a considerable level of non-compliance, although it may also just be modelling error, or it may be behavioural response, or maybe actually there aren't as many people above £50,000 anymore, and so on. And my guess would be that there's significant non-compliance going on there, possibly lots of people that just don't know about this, and the revenue don't have very much a way to make sure they do withdraw the money from them. Of course, the result of withdrawing child benefit like this is that we now have two separate benefits for children that are means tested. At the moment, child tax credit, being rolled into universal credit, and child benefit. And again, it's hard to see a very good principled reason why we should be having two means tested benefits for children that are done separately and means tested in different ways. The marriage allowance is also not, I think, working perfectly. So this is worth £237 a year for most eligible couples. That's just the that's just basic rate tax on 10% of the personal allowance. About one in three married couples or civil partners were due to be eligible for this. That's actually disproportionately those without children, because this is often framed in terms of helping families with children, and a lot of pensioners, for example, are gaining from this. They're generally in the lower middle part of the income distribution, precisely because two-earner couples can't gain and because higher rate taxpayers don't gain. Unlike the personal allowance, it does benefit unlike just increasing the normal personal allowance, it does benefit lower income families, though not those right at the bottom who don't have any taxpayers at all. Now, initially, it was very widely reported that very few people were taking this up, less than 10% of those eligible, during the first year, though some could claim it afterwards. Now it's about 60%, so we are still well short of full take-up. HMRC is still saying in its publications that it anticipates full take-up, although quite why it anticipates that I'm not entirely sure. It would cost the government about £600 million if take-up were full, so it should be around £400 million that the government is actually spending on this. So finally, let me say a little bit about what do we know, coming back to what I was saying about the effects of some of these on incentives to being couples or to marry or be not, also in terms of impact on children. So this is a very brief, very crude summary of a literature which I'm not as steeped in as some of my colleagues, but I think this is all fair to say. The evidence we've got, limited as it is, suggests that there is some effect on financial incentives to get married or stay married, and indeed some incentives of support, some effect of support for children on people's actual childbearing decisions. Those effects, however, are very small. I don't think anyone has really found big effects on family formation and family composition decisions. There does appear to be a bigger effect on people's reported status. So about 10 years ago, my colleagues at IFS did a bit of digging around statistics, which suggested that in fact there were more lone parents receiving child tax credit than there were lone parents in the country, which, again, there may have been some complications around slightly different definitions of what constitutes a lone parent, and I think Gillian might say a bit more about that kind of thing. But at least some of that looks like people who are reporting not being in a couple when in fact they are. I haven't checked whether those statistics basically still hold. What I have checked is recent government statistics, which says that the government estimates that it is overpaying more than £500 million a year in benefits and tax credits as a result of people falsely claiming to be living without a partner. That's a fairly substantial amount of money. It's more, for example, than the government is spending on the marriage allowance, though it certainly doesn't get as much attention. Okay, I will just say it. There is little evidence that marriage per se benefits children. Controversial statement, I know. As far as we can tell from the best of the evidence we've got, it looks like, so certainly children of married parents seem to have better outcomes. Once you take account of the fact that people who get married tend to come from more privileged backgrounds, have higher incomes, higher levels of education, and so on, it looks like the difference in outcomes of the children is basically being driven by the characteristics of the people who marry rather than whether they are married at all. And, of course, there's a further step, which is, as far as I'm aware, there is no evidence that those people, those small number of extra people who get married or stay married because of the financial incentives, that benefits children in any way. I do think that is a fair reading of the evidence. I would stress that these things are pretty difficult to test accurately and reliably, so I'm not going to stake my life on that being quite the end of the story. So, to conclude very briefly, there are delicate trade-offs and value judgments. I am sitting on the fence. There are tensions between what to me are sensible sounding principles. It is very hard to see how you can get everything that you would like. And thinking about example cases of, well, should this kind of person or this kind of couple pay more or less than that kind of person or that kind of couple, I find it hard to design a system that would achieve everything that I would want it to achieve. What the UK has is a hybrid system with broadly independent taxation of earnings, more like optional joint assessment of capital, and broadly speaking, joint assessment of means testing for benefits and tax credits for couples rather than for cohabiting couples rather than for spouses and civil partners, which is always what's mattered for tax. I think you can make a reasonable defence of a hybrid system broadly along the lines of independent taxation and joint benefit assessment, although I think there is also, for example, a respectable case for joint income taxation. I find it a little bit harder to make a case for independent benefit taxation, essentially paying benefits to the spouse or partner of a millionaire. But what I would say is that the recent reforms we've seen with the high income child benefit charge and the marriage allowance do make it hard to find a discernible principle in what the government is trying to do with a combination of individual and joint assessment in the system. With that, I'll stop.
Thank you.